No matter how often the events occurred, Aldo never failed to be amazed each time he made first contact with an alien life form. The blepharospads, the goiters, the embryons, the heebie-jeebies, the Clevelanders, the Parolians, the chaoticians. Each initial meeting had been unique and offered numerous opportunities to get interspecies relations off of the wrong foot, or whatever means they were using to accommodate gravitational reality. But this last first contact with the, well, he never did catch its name, the creature that resembled pressed burlap and rosin, had been especially unsettling because it wasn't an encounter so much as it was a collision. As far as Aldo could tell, both he and the alien had been caught in the throes of an Algonquin hole as it tore yet another snippet from the fabric of the fabled space-time continuum. He had parted company with the last remaining member of his mining shack comrades when the Inuition bailed out of the Hudson wingback seconds before it and part of a radio tower vanished from a patch of highly unstable Clegmore real estate. Sensing that his tokamak had had a hand in the event, Aldo had remained in the car, curious to see what next law of physics the still disassembled device might discombobulate. A low-frequency hum gradually replaced the susurrus of static from the car radio speakers, which rose and fell coincident with his surroundings oozing into and out of focus. Suddenly, everything outside the Hudson dissolved into the visual equivalent of a hiccup, and Aldo slipped into a bizarrely different, but somehow pleasant, alternate universe. Unfortunately, the pleasantness did not last long. His tokamak, determined to maintain instability in the time-space continuum, kept shunting him from dimension to dimension, from reality to reality. He had decided not to abandon the device for fear of what it might do all by itself, not that he ever exercised the slightest control over it. In each new universe, the sky was blue-black and the car radio worked, but nearly all other aspects of reality made U-turns and tried to distance themselves from him as rapidly as possible. This time, the Hudson was, for want of a better word, parked, which is a perfectly fine word after all, perpendicular to the pinnacle of a mountain. Nearby were a heifer, a weeping stone, a willow tree, a kingfisher, a white bull, a piece of golden fleece, and a young man drinking a cafe latte. In the valley below, he spotted several people lounging about in toga-like attire. From the declivity of the mountain and the position of the sun relative to the undeniable tokamakic influence on it, he deduced he was on Mount Olympus. But whether he was in western Washington or northern Greece, he did not know. He put the Hudson in gear and drove slowly down the mountain. There was no road, and the angle of descent approached 100 degrees. Certainly this was a motoring adventure that should never be attempted without a tokamak. At the bottom of the mountain, 24 bumpy miles later, the degrees changed to Celsius, and Aldo nearly swooned from the suddenly oppressive heat. He passed the mythological counterpart of a 12-unit motel whose jagged shadow provided welcome shade to a nearby kennel of sweltering dogwood trees. A paved street branched off from the motel, and he followed it cautiously. It led straight to a large, ornate building, whence issued a caterwauling of such chimerically fierce proportions that Aldo stopped the car at once. Or rather, the car's forward motion was suddenly compromised by emanations from the toroidal magnetic chamber that was taped to his jerkin. As he stepped from the Hudson, a strapping young lad with biceps the size of anteaters stomped menacingly out of the building. If this was a local Chamber of Commerce's idea of a meet and greet, he wanted none of it.
Meet and greet?
Yeah.
Is that like a thing?
It is. Haven't you heard of meet and greets?
Never.
Oh, it was a disgusting thing that I, in a former employmental situation, had to address while, in fact, attired as a plastic moonhead with sunglasses.
Wow. Okay. Meet and greet.
Meet ampersand greet.
Yeah. Oh, I see. I see. I thought it had something to do with, like, hot dish or casserole.
Oh, one could meet and greet
yeah,
with
there you
one.
Are. Right, exactly.
Now, where was I? Ah, the bottom of the declivity. The lad gesticulated so threateningly that Aldo figured he'd better forget introductory social amenities and go right to Plan Z. Shoot first and form a committee to ask questions later. He removed the pulsating reality hazard from his jerkin, set it down on the ground, and flicked a toggle switch to on. As normalcy as he knew it took another holiday and the ruffian began to lose his focal points, Aldo took time to examine his surroundings. The house grounds were full of Baroque sculptures of giant armed ants, possibly of ancient Greek influence. Sleek marble fountains spat water into a semicircular poolatorium in which sullen fish awaited their destiny as luncheon fare. A portable sarcophagus in the driveway awaited disassembly from a recent camping and looting trip, in the Aegean region known as the Flambeau Orange.
Flambeau Orange.
Three betogued babes peered at him inquisitively from a second-floor window shrouded in bunting.
They were, or the window?
They both were.
They were betogued and shrouded.
And bunted.
And bunted. I like
the
concept.
Or be bunted.
Be bunted.
A loud swoosh caused him to glance. Swoosh! A loud swoosh caused him to glance up further. And as amazed as Aldo often was when trying to cope with new and wholly fantastic wonders, he was utterly flabbergasted now to see the planet Neptune bearing down upon him. Hoping for at least one more tokamakic reprieve, he gamely looked the other way, left, toward his car radio, whence caterwauling of a different nature signaled, than Calvo's and Damien's new music bazaar. This 139th episode of which rarely looks the other way, preferring instead to stare contemporary music, no matter its total lack of saving grace, right in the snoot.
It's toga lack of saving grace, as it were, in this case.
It were.
We're listening to Bark by Drew Krause, Back in Two.
I have one more sentence. Don't I get it? Do I have to finish it later?
Oh, you have another sentence?
I guess it's superfluous now, isn't it?
Yes, please. Superfluous way.
And one snoot whose nasaline perceptions we've nearly grown to trust over the course of the past 16,560 minutes of digitally demonstrative radiophonic program is that of he who's already bespake.
Bespake.
Calv.
That's me. Drew Krauss. Music by Drew Krause.
What a coda.
Yes.
Played by
the thump piano duo, Drew Krause and Paul Marquardt.
With some assistance, was there not?
Computer-generated tape.
Oh,
you betcha. On today's Preponderance of Pianos Day here on the Bazaar, the preponderance and plethora of pianos, the pollution of pianos, we will hear today.
How pithy.
How pithy. Our guest is Philip Silver, who will be with us at the top of the hour. He's a performer of contemporary music on piano, and he speaks some interesting things about it, and he does some wordplay, piano play, and other such. So we'll hear him in about 15 minutes. And today we have Jean Baraquet, who was born today in 1928. And when I was a little sprout, I kind of get attracted to some of his tunes. And one of the pieces I got attracted to was something called For Six Percussionists, by the way, Voice and Piano, piano's listed third, a thing called Chant Après Chant, piece from 1966. So shall we just...
Oh, Barack Away.
Barack Away. Thank you. An excerpt from Chant après Chant by Jean Baraquet.
That's Dog After Dog, is that how that translates?
Dog After Dog. It should be Dog After Dog. Actually, some pieces don't age well. I suppose that's one of them. I haven't heard that in about 20 years. It's attractive, still well done, but just a bit of a surprise. Well, let's listen to a little bit more on our plethora of pianos, our preponderance. What would be pollution of pianos? I kind of like that. Pollution
serves,
of pianos day, yes. Here's some music by Elma Miller. This is for piano four hands. It's called, I can never even figure out how to pronounce this thing, Synaedesis 12?
You're asking me?
Yes, okay.
Mr. Language?
Yes, it is for piano four hands, music by Elma Miller. on Pollution of Pianos Day here on the Calvos on Damien New Music Bazaar on WGDR. Plainfield, that was...
No Notes Held Back.
No Notes Held Back. All spilled right out there, just all over the floor like a wrecked Exxon Valdez.
That's true. That's true.
Music by Elma Miller, Synodesis 12 in memoriam, Robert Langstedt. Performers not identified on that recording, and I really hope that somewhere in there there's a master tape with a bit higher quality to it, because I think that's a dandy piece.
Yes. I wonder if there are 11 prequels to that tune.
You think? That would be a lot of notes. About pollution.
Right. Which we do from time to time.
Well, our interview today is with Philip Silver, at the Red Kettle restaurant.
And I believe in that venue we identified him, did we not?
We did identify him. We'll get to that point. And right up ahead of it, we did a little level check. It was such a lovely level check. I think we need to hear it, don't you?
Oh, obviously.
Yes, here we are. Going off to the Red Kettle. Now that's how you do a level check.
Obviously, it's amazing. One doesn't hear it more often, but we're not perhaps as remiss.
Right.
It's a great honor to be sitting here with one of the early comedians of television. If you remember, it's a mad world, or especially the wonderful Sergeant Bilko.
Sergeant Bilko.
Of the Yukon.
Of the Yukon, yes. Yeah. So this Mighty Dog Fella.
Is that Fella? I thought it was heliotrope, but it may have been an
No, that was a rag by Scott Joplin.
The rag was the dog.
Yes.
The dog was...
Heliotrope Bernard was the name of it.
I had forgotten, but you're quite right. Anyway, we are sitting here, Kettle Avec Red, with our guest, Phil Silvers, long a television comedian, and it's just a real honor. He doesn't look at all like you remember him on the television.
Not at all. And if he hasn't aged a day.
Not a day.
Well, I want you guys to know that when I came back from the dead, I changed my name. I took the S off the Silvers, okay?
Yes.
And I added the IP to Phil.
Silver?
Close.
Okay.
Okay?
Grand. I stand corrected. Again.
Well, actually, you're sitting right now.
I sit. Some sense.
I am no longer capable of going on. I think that was quite satisfactory. We are indeed here on the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar, the show which you failed to mention at the outset.
Is that ever necessary?
It is never necessary because, well, this is one of these time things, you know.
Oh, no, the time-space
difference. Oh, yes, that is the Algonquin hole down which we always fall. The Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar, here at the Red Kettle Restaurant in Northfield, Vermont, just outside of downtown, with our guest, Philip Silver.
Yes, of course. I somehow suspected that, but I didn't want to look a gift silver in the mouth.
Okay. True enough. And he is a performer of new music. Now, this is a rare event, because most of the time we have composers and the occasional composer-performer. But here we have someone whose main thrust is at the keyboard performing contemporary pieces. We have a compact disc from which we will be playing excerpts, and a purloined cassette as well. And also some new... a brand new release, which at the time we are sitting here, we do not have in front of us. But by the time you hear this, we will. I love these time-space things. That's just great.
Yes, I think, though, that his idea of putting Brahms in with contemporary music is a little far afield, but we'll discuss this later.
Yeah, true enough. Welcome to the show, Philip Silver.
Thank you very much, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here.
Is it? Oh, good. We're never sure.
As long as the coffee holds out, it's a pleasure.
Yes. Right. Now, tell us a little bit about your background, because I first heard from you via the internet from Scotland.
Where I am based.
And you said, what's it like in Vermont? And I thought, this is an odd thing. And the conversation continued. And you, please, fill us in the details.
Your
life, hopes, dreams,
aspirations.
Aspirations and... failures, too.
But no bank account numbers. Actually, I'm a New Yorker. Born in Brooklyn. I could say bread there, but that sounds like a dish, so I won't say it. I studied in Boston at New England Conservatory. I've traveled a lot. I've lived in dozens of places, including Boston, Seattle, San Francisco, London, Jerusalem, and presently Glasgow, Scotland, where I am a renowned professor of music and chamber music performer.
Do you find the new music scene vastly different in Britain than in the United States?
I find the new music scene vastly missing in Britain.
Well, actually, we have a quite good composer from Scotland. I should bring this up, but of course I can't remember her name. Isn't that wonderful? What a wonderful job.
Janet Weir?
Yeah, I think so. That's right.
Janet's very, very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's wonderful. That shows something I wasn't aware of. And you're saying that other than perhaps that, there isn't much to be had.
Well, there seems to be very, very little. Audiences in Scotland are very, very conservative. And unless you have a major figure such as, say, James McMillan, who has become the prominent Scottish composer right now, he seems to have overshadowed everyone else, you won't get people coming to the concert. And even then, you can only restrict it to one particular venue, which would be the Royal Concert Hall in Glasgow, or maybe one of the university series. But generally, there's a big chamber music scene all through Scotland. There's a network of music societies, music clubs. Every small town has it. But if you try to program something beyond late Romantic or early 20th century, you won't be accepted. You'll have no audience. So that's what I mean when I say it seems to be lacking. There isn't really a center for it. In London, you have more opportunity. The Roundhouse is a good opportunity. It's a good place for people doing contemporary music. If you don't, I haven't found it in Scotland. If it exists, I hope one of your listeners will contact me by email and let me know where to go.
Well, then what drew you to Scotland in the first place? Or do you just like to change your living place and your view of the world, whatever?
Well, it's personal. My wife is from Scotland. We met, we were students in Boston. We traveled everywhere. And we're doing a lot of performing in Israel. We're members of an ensemble there. I got into financial difficulties. And
Were you Crazy Eddie?
Was I Crazy Eddie?
Yeah.
The used car salesman? No.
Electronic.
No, I wasn't. We were part of a group called the Van Leer Ensemble. And I used to also work with a contemporary music group out of Tel Aviv University that David Bloch would run. So he would introduce people like the music of Chelsea, Wernick, and people who were unknown to Israel with a series of concerts that were sometimes attended and sometimes were not attended. Like my first year in Israel, he introduced Chelsea, and my wife and I were invited to play, and we did one of the cello pieces there. But things became very difficult financially after this group began to fold, and we decided to go back to Scotland, where she was from, and stay at her parents' house, since that would...
How convenient.
Wasn't that convenient? And then, of course, something unfortunate happened. Her mother died shortly after we arrived, and it was difficult for her to leave. So we finally stayed there longer than we intended to, and work began to pour in. I teach at several universities and the Conservatory of Music up there, the Royal Scottish Academy. I've got a trio of two Russians who defected and wound up there. I also play with my wife, and it's very accessible to get from there to Germany and other places where I play. So I'm waiting for your next question as to why I want to leave.
Yeah, well, that is, of course, the inevitable next question.
Well, I've never felt comfortable there. It's beautiful scenery. It's very friendly people. But it's still somehow culturally very alien to me. And I feel much more at home in America, which is something I never thought I'd say after when I left originally. But it's true. And so we're looking to reestablish ourselves if we can. But we have three kids, and so it becomes a little bit difficult to just pick up and go, which is what we would have done earlier on in our relationship. And Vermont is a place I love because, as I say, I studied in Boston. I used to rent part of a place in Putney when I was a student. I have very fond memories of the place.
So you would like to be more closely affiliated with the Kalos and Damian Classifieds on the website?
Absolutely.
That can be arranged.
Well, let's take an eating break here, and while we're doing that, let's listen to something. What's a good choice?
Well, it's not exactly avant-garde, but it wouldn't be known to anybody here. How about the scherzo from the trio by Georgi Spiridov?
Right, this is indeed not exactly avant-garde. This is my first reaction in hearing this was a latter-day Kalinikov, someone who, from the sort of heritage of the minor Russian Romantic era.
Well, this man had to conform to the Soviet standards, and he did. He told the line very, very carefully, was very much aware of the fact that, particularly when he wrote this piece, that if you didn't toe the line, nasty things could happen to you.
Right.
And he maintained that tradition all through his career. He's still alive. He's 81 years old right now. Sort of one of the elder statesmen.
Do you know if he still writes? His style has changed at all?
His style never really changed. It became more folk-oriented. This was just after he completed his studies with Shostakovich, and it really shows the influence of his teacher.
It's a piece from 1945. This is a 1955 revision that you're performing.
That's right.
Okay, here it is. The Scherzo, Allegro Vivo, from Georgi Spiridov's piano trio, performed by the Rachmaninoff trio, which is Lev Atlas, Alexander Volpov, and Philip Silver, our guests. Thank you. From the classic avant-garde of the 1940s. No, wait, wrong again. From the classic romantic of the 1940s. Music by Georgi Sviridov at the Scherzo from the Piano Trio, 1945. And our guest is Philip Silver.
Thank you.
Well, yes, thank you.
Explain this piece.
Yes, how did you find it?
I didn't find it. The two guys I play with found it. These two people were part of a string quartet that defected in the last years of the Soviet Union and wound up in Britain. And when we formed this trio, they said, we really would like to concentrate on Russian-Soviet repertoire. And that was fine with me. And they said, have you ever heard of this? I said, never. They said, great piece. It's very popular in Russia. Okay, so let's play it. And it's, weirdly enough, it's very popular with audiences in Britain, too. Mainly because it's so accessible.
Yeah, it has that lilt. Is it not only the feeling of Shostakovich, but also Prokofiev in there. It has that lightness, and they're also both the light and the dark. That's what's kind of interesting about it, that the slow movements have that undercurrent of very, very dark, again, that 19th century sound almost.
That's right. Well, the slow movement in this one certainly is cribbed almost totally from Shostakovich. And the scherzo is cribbed almost totally from Shostakovich. I mean, if you compare this to the scherzo of the Shostakovich second trio, sometimes you have difficulty knowing which is which at times. And we've often done that. If we play this work in concert, we'll encore it with the Shostakovich scherzo and vice versa. And it seems as if we're continuing with the same piece. But it's by no means great music. It's just one of these pieces that is easy to take. And as I say, audiences like it. As long as they like it, performers need to play it. And
there's also on the same CD, there's Rachmaninoff and Shostakovich. So from what you've said, it's with the Russian emigres, it's interesting to be doing this music. You as a New Yorker.
Oh, I'm a New Yorker. But actually, my grandparents came from Russia anyway. So just skip one generation. I've sort of gone back to earlier roots.
Okay. How did you, you've also, hear some of these, performed some other new compositions. How do you find them? You just recently drove up from New York where you met with Charlemagne Palestine. Was that to attempt to do some of his material, or did you just want to meet him?
He was an old friend, actually.
Okay.
We hadn't seen each other for a long time. And then I ran across some of his discs. And actually, I hadn't heard a lot of his music because when he was really doing this stuff in the 70s, I was doing some other stuff, which maybe I won't talk about on the air.
Might be valuable.
You might want to close it off and then we'll talk about it and you can tell me. But anyway, when I finally got an address from him in France, I discovered after I contacted him there that he wasn't there anymore. He was in Amsterdam. Contacted him there and found out that he was going to be in Brooklyn about the same time I was. So we got together and we talked a lot. And I'm going to try to get him into Scotland right now. He's very interested in presenting stuff because he's doing playing again. In the last 2 years he started writing and performing again.
Yes.
And he hasn't done that since 1974, really. So that's how I wound up meeting with him.
Is that what influenced your interest in doing new stuff in the past, having known him then, or you're always interested in it? I ask the question because finding performers who are interested in doing music past the 1950s or whatever is sometimes a very difficult task.
Yeah.
How did you get there?
Well, basically, I got there through John Cage. I never really was attracted to surrealism. When I was a student, I found it a little bit too dry. I liked the emphasis on possibility, a chance of something happening that is unintended, but it's just the coming together of various possible elements at that particular moment. It can never be repeated again. And that appealed to me very, very much because it's very, very much my world philosophy of all these streams that come together. And the present moment of life is just that meeting of these streams. And it can never be the same for two people. It can never be duplicated. And to find that represented in sound is what first got me into, I would say, post-1950 music. And it's kind of continued. Everywhere I go, composers seem to contact me. And sometimes I play it, and sometimes I don't play it. When I was living in Jerusalem, after about 2 weeks, I was introduced to the music of Chelsea. I hadn't heard Chelsea's music before, but a friend of mine runs a new music series there, and he asked my wife and I to play some of his music. And so we had this put in front of us, and I'd never seen anything like it in my life. I had no idea what to make of it, but the more we worked on it, the more, you know, fascinating and drawn into the world we became. And I find that...
Oh, yes, of course.
Absolutely.
More coffee and a chocolate cream pie.
Pecan?
Just love. Blueberry? One of the advantages of recording here is that we have the opportunity to have our dessert and eat it.
This was worth the flight from Scotland, I'll tell you that right now.
So you're talking about the Chelsea.
The Chelsea.
Music, yes.
That opened up a new world to me. And from Chelsea I went to various Israeli composers who were working in various streams. None of them were really known outside of the country, but I found them very interesting. And then coming to Britain, we tried to involve ourselves with composers who were new. There's a Macmillan piece that we recorded. This is coming up, I think, later in the program. So basically, I'm open to new sound. I'm kind of in love, periodically, with traditional music, with the Romantics. But there are times also I am so oversatiated with it, since it's accompanied me all my life, that I feel if I'm going to have to play this, I'm going to get out of the profession. And it's always then so refreshing to go into something brand new. And I think it's just exciting to be at your present moment in time and to know what people are thinking, what people are doing. And maybe a lot of it isn't going to survive. It probably isn't. But who knows? You don't know until you try it. And it doesn't even matter if it survives. If you like it, you do it.
How many composers have you worked with? What's that like?
Well, some are very laissez-faire. Oh, you feel it works this way better than I put down? Okay, do it. Some are very, very specific. I mean, you know, the situation. No, I'm sorry, that note does not belong like that. It has to be a very specific way. This phrase is not being approached correctly because you're leading it to the wrong place. Okay, so some people don't want that much flexibility in an interpretation. All right, if you find there's enough value in what's happening, if you can enjoy the sounds, if you can enjoy the concepts, if you can make sense out of the idea, or even the moment, then you work with people and see what they want to say. I personally like the, okay, you feel it works better that way? There's more than one way to skin a cat. Do it that way. When I was a student, I remember I worked with Eugene Lehner, coached the group. I was doing Piero Lunaire at the conservatory, and Lehner was the coach. I remember he liked to interject stories, one of which was when the Kolisch Quartet was working on the Ravel Quartet. And he told us there was a moment in which they felt something did not work. And they were a little apprehensive to go to Ravel and say it. But they eventually did, and Ravel just said, doesn't work, change it. And somehow that concept has stayed with me. If something doesn't work, you do need a performer. I think I take the 19th century element that a work of music is a synthesis of a composer and the performer at a given moment in time. And if the performer has no say in any aspect of it, then it becomes very, very difficult. It's very difficult to lose your personality, because it is simply the result of your life, of your experiences. And to say, no, I have to forget that, is for me a very, very difficult thing to do.
When did you have to do that? When was that your experience?
That was my experience, certainly when I was working on the Chelsea. When I worked with the organizer of the concert, he was very specific about it having to be exact. And we kept saying, you know, David is... He's a very, very fine musician, David Bloch. David, it feels a little bit freer here. And unless we could check back with Chelsea himself, he didn't want us to do that. And so we stayed very, very closely in touch with what was on the page itself.
Do you feel any composition, if that's the word, from electronic production techniques now? Do composers turn to MIDI pianos to get their exactitude as opposed to you?
No, I don't go to competition because many composers still use a natural piano. And I sincerely doubt they'll ever run out of composers doing that. Simply because there is something that happens on the moment that cannot be duplicated. No matter how exact your interpretation is with a score, you know that something different could happen a little bit later. And I think certainly many composers I've run across are keeping certain romantic tendencies within themselves. And that they kind of echo certain romantic statements I've read. Liszt playing a work of Schumann, and Schumann saying, "I never conceived of it that way." Or Chopin saying, "I'm hearing Liszt play my etudes now. I never conceived it this way, but now I can't conceive it any other way." And so it's wonderful to suddenly have this type of relationship, which becomes a communal relationship in the development of a work. I'm probably making you angry.
Not me.
Not you? Okay.
I decided that I like the sound of the piano at all clicking when it's released. It has become part of the piece. But that will be mentioned later.
And Damien is still bleeding a little bit from a recording session recently in which the piano's mechanism and performers were more obvious than the notes. Well, let's listen to Messiaen. No, let's listen to some Macmillan.
Early Macmillan. So it sounds like Messiaen. He's changed the style.
Tell us a little bit about Macmillan.
Well, James Macmillan is, I'm not certain how prominent he's become in this country, but certainly within Britain and Europe, he seems to become one of the major voices of the time. I know Rostropovich has commissioned a work from him. Evelyn Glennie is playing his music. He is represented on the London platform very seriously. And there's consistent, I would say, rave reviews from critics. His music, you have to listen to it because it changes from piece to piece. But he's very much influenced by Scottish folk elements, Scottish mythology. And he's a very religious person, like Messiaen, so Catholicism does enter his music also. But the work that's going to be played is a very early work that, in a way, he was almost sheepish about when he found out we were doing it. The story behind it is the BBC was going to have this broadcast, and the original people couldn't do it, and we were asked to do it. Should I name names? You know, drop names or not? No.
Up to you.
No, I'm not going to do it.
We love names, but...
You love it. Okay, no, I'm not going to do it.
The piece is good.
Anyway, we were asked. My wife and I were asked to do it. And we looked at it and agreed to it. It was very, very... It was a beautiful piece of music, we thought. Very much like Messiaen. And Macmillan came to our house to listen to us and to work with us on it a little bit. And he apologized and said, "I don't write like this anymore. I mean, this is an early piece. But I'm glad you're playing it." And we left it at that. And so you have to make your own decision. This
is let's hear that Messiaen influence and see how it goes. The name of the piece is...
Study on Two Planes.
Study on Two Planes. And you mentioned your wife is playing, and her name...
Her name is Noreen Silver.
Noreen Silver.
Without an S at the end.
Philip Silver playing the music of James Macmillan.
Thank you.
Was the quartet for the end of time, music by James McMillan. Oh no, wait. What was that?
We did want to just compare. Don't you think it would be
compare and contrast? Yes, I think a little bit later on, after we've bid a fond adieu to our guest Philip Silver here on the Calvin Damian New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield.
And that was the piece for, let's see, Lufthansa and British Airways. Is that correct?
No, I think that's Bizet, actually.
Lufthansa, British Airways, and
Bizet. Yeah.
Right. I thought we played music on two planes.
Or was it Lochner?
Well, this is
two planes.
Three planes? How many planes was it?
This is two planes.
Two planes.
I had the wrong airline.
Yes. Yes.
But this may be the rain on Spain falling mainly on these planes. Okay.
You're playing the rain of Spain.
That's right.
That's what we were talking about sheep before, speaking of which. And how, what was the issue about sheep in Scotland? Is that why you left? Maybe you eat that.
No, I'm still there.
And you refuse.
No, I won't eat them.
I'm still there, which again repeats the third pluperfect axiom of the time-space continuum. That was, he is here, but also there.
And not eating sheep.
Not that we can tell.
No,
there's at least two living sheep now, thanks to me.
Ooh. And they write you regularly? You know, sort of those...
Yes, they
were
both...
their eyes wide.
They were both elected to Parliament in the last elections. They are both very happy.
Like a student in Parliament? Wow.
This is going a bit far.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm
feeling... Yeah, we're looking a little sheepish right now, so I think we should stop.
Oh.
Oh.
The music. Yeah. You have some stuff coming out. What is that? Is there a time when we can expect to see it?
Well, the stuff that's coming out is again traditional right now. We've got the second Rachmaninoff trio coming out with the two Russians. My wife and I were asked to do a recording of the complete cello piano works of Ignaz Moscheles.
What?
I'm not making this up.
You were commissioned?
We were asked. The Moscheles family still has descendants.
And money, apparently.
Well, not that much money, but a lot of interest. And we thought, well, why not? We'll take a look at this. And as I mentioned before, I get awfully tired playing the same music, but I guess this is not the same music, it's quite different. And we kind of got to like it in its own homely way. And so you can expect to see that, hopefully, anytime in the next dozen years, whenever this company gets it out.
What label will it be on?
It'll be on the Koch Schwan label.
Oh, those are the, yes, we know those. We played David Ott's cello concerto, which is on that label. Yeah, so... So what else do we expect to see here?
What else do you expect to hear?
Yes.
I couldn't tell you.
Ah.
I could not tell you.
But you are looking for, if not recorded, at least a concert. You are always interested in seeing interesting new scores.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it's an invitation to send new scores to me.
You ever get so irked by scores that you've seen that you think, I can do better than this, and you sit down to scrawl notes over a piece of manuscript paper? Has that happened yet?
No, I actually don't do that. What I do is I support the legs of cabinets that are kind of lopsided. I put the scores directly under them, and they make wonderful balance, you know?
It's always an interesting question. Have you ever had the urge to be writing your own material after you've seen enough bad piano scores?
Yeah, I did. But, unfortunately, Fortunately, I have 3 children. And to find a moment to concentrate and think about something is a very great luxury in my life these days. Fortunately, I can play between lessons that I'm teaching at the Academy of Music in Scotland. But to sit down and actually try to write something these days, I can't do. When I was a student at NEC, I actually did try to compose, and I wrote a few pieces that remained uncirculated, and thank heavens my reputation is still intact.
There's still time to bring them before the public.
No, there isn't. They went the way of the dodo a long time ago.
And the sheep, certain sheep.
No, the sheep is still alive.
They were electrocuted.
Yes, and I'm dreaming about them all the time.
Sorry. More music.
More music. Yes, we'll hear some. Actually, we don't know what we're going to hear right now, so we'll actually save the introduction to it for the actual broadcast of this interview.
Well, I happen to know what it is, but I've been sworn to secrecy. I cannot reveal my sources either, but I do know what is coming, and I think it will be a treat.
Here it comes, music performed by our guest, Philip Silver.
By a treat.
You may have thought it was going to be a treat, but I know differently now. Here it is, the Allegro non troppo from Shostakovich's Trio No. 2 in E minor, played by the Rachmaninoff Trio. That's Lev Atlas, Alexander Folpov, and Philip Silver, our guest, on piano. Little Shostakovich for the afternoon.
Yeah, give that avant-garde a little rest.
That's right. That's the Allegro non troppo from the trio sonata, the trio number 2 in E minor, that from 1944 by Shostakovich. With Philip Silver, our guest who will be back with us again for the conclusion of his interview next week.
That's about, we stumbled through the dessert, I think, during the next section of the interview.
Something like that, yes. Well, it's Pollution of Pianos Day here on the Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield.
And we have plenty of them.
Right, and you've got something by one of our local geniuses in the
local legend. Start local off legends. With William Bolcom's The Serpent's Kiss, performed by Michael Arnowitz. Thank you. Yes, Fade, performance of William Folkham's The Serpent's Kiss by Michael Arnowitz in a bootleg recording that we hope you will never
stealth
about.
Stealth. That's right. What we call it, stealth recordings now.
Oh, all right.
A bootleg is only when you issue it as a commercial release.
This is absolutely stealthified.
And now let's turn to... Actually, these things we're playing today are largely unavailable in any form in the performances you hear. So
that one certainly is unavailable.
Right, exactly, and as was the Alma Miller and several of the other pieces. So we're going to continue in that vein in Pollution of Pianos today with two pieces by Clarence Barlow, one called Bacchanal, a very short one, and the second one, Ode de Bleu. And both of these are for the Resendorfer Pianola, specially tuned for purposes of these pieces.
Oh, play away.
Here they are, music by Clarence Barlow. Thank you. Clarence Barlow's Ode to the Blue. And before that, Bacchanal. Real short one.
A swell tune.
It is a swell tune. One of my faves.
Does it mention on the cassette who the piano player is? And I think not enough attention is given to the piano tuner as well. That's really quite a remarkable
tuning
process.
In this particular case, yes. Actually, this is an automatic Bosendorfer. It's a Bosendorfer piano with the extended range and a full acoustic instrument, but it's played with this keenest device that's hooked up to it. This was not the automatic pianos like the Yamahas, which are essentially MIDI-controlled devices, modern-age devices, which have the, say about that, the mechanism built in to pull the keys down and play the strings. Rather, this was a device built at the conservatory in Amsterdam that consisted of a rack that bolted to the piano with metal solenoids and wooden felt-covered plungers that would play the keys from above. This is a handmade device.
Oh.
And it's quite a treat to watch. One of our future guests, who we've crossed paths with and haven't been able to sit down for an interview, is Alcedo Koenen. And Alcedo wrote a piece for this device where it never actually plays the notes most of the time, but the plungers simply come down and tap the key tops in a certain order, and once in a while they play a few notes. So it's almost as if there's a ghost player attempting to do a piece on this instrument. It's quite lovely to watch because the thing is exposed. All the plungers and solenoids and rods all operate in front of you as you're watching them. Quite a treat. Anyway, that by Clarence Barlow. Udo Kazemets is next. This is a piece performed by Stephen Clark for solo piano. This is just an excerpt from a long work called Pythagoras Tree, music by Udo Kazemets. Thank you. just an excerpt from a very long work, about a 40-minute work called Pythagoras Tree by Udo Kazimetz. And in that, the guise of that first movement sounds a bit like just sort of noodling at the keyboard that we would do, but it's has mathematical base.
So they say.
So
anyone can throw together an algorithm, or better yet, just play any noodle and someone will say, oh, I know the algorithm on which that is based.
Well, who said that to us? Actually, one of the composers we interviewed said that she had written a piece completely intuitively and musically from the perspective of the sound, and someone kept insisting that it had to have been algorithmically based.
Was that Allison?
It may well have been, yes, Allison Cameron. Yes, I believe so, who said no matter what she said, this guy insisted that the piece was algorithmic, even if she didn't know it.
Yes.
Don't we love that? Let's go on to something from the Fun Music Festival. This is FUN is an acronym for the Festival of Ugly Music.
Oh, good.
This is held at the Smith Recital Hall in Urbana, Illinois. This is James Bone's Sonata for Two Pianos, played by the ever-wonderful Thump Piano Duo. Thank you. Sonata for Two Pianos by James Bohn. That's B-O-H-N. That's the Thump Piano Duo, Drew Krause and Paul Marquardt.
Who've been heard a number of times on here. Always a treat to hear these bonkers.
Yes, they are very, very good. That's from the Festival of Ugly Music, concert number 2 of 6 or so concerts that they gave out there last year, last summer in Urbana, Illinois. How about Blue Strider?
Ghost Rider?
Yes, Ghost Rider. Blue Strider. This is music by Jeff Harrington.
Oh, him.
Yeah.
He's coming on the show.
He will be coming on the show not long from now. Jeff is kind of a prickly guy sometimes. I'm not sure if he's a prickly guy or he just likes to do the prickly guy routine. Because he was soft and sweet with us.
He was, but let's see if this music reflects that.
Here it is. Blue Strider? No, Blue Strider.
Thank you.
Music by Jeff Harrington, labeled Blue Strider for piano, though it seemed to have had a little help from a few other instruments.
That was the Strider part.
The Strider part?
I think so.
Much more strident than the blue part, indeed. And, well, we got lots more pianos next week. We are full of
Are we
pianos.
Continuing the plethora of...
The pollution of pianos. So yes. Next week we'll have the punishment of pianos. As we continue
good.
With our interview with Philip Silver.
You this can is have, no reflection on Mr. Silver's, is it?
Well, he'll punish some Ben Haim next week and a few other composers.
Oh, that's good. That's
and
good.
We'll punish a few more pianos next week ourselves. That's the Calvos and Damian show for today. Do check our playlists and pictures of all these handsome composers on the web. Look up Malted Media. There you'll find us. And next week, more Silver. And coming up later, Harrington, who we just heard, and many other composers all the way up through June when we start our new series of composers.
Ooh, where? Where will we find them?
Oh, we'll find them.
Well, good. And we're going out with whom?
With John Cage. This is the first of the three dances for two amplified prepared pianos. And you have the performer list there?
Oh, yeah. These Michael Tilson Thomas and Ralph Grierson. Playing real pianos, not that fake Bösendorfer thing that old Clarence was playing.
Here they are, real amplified, prepared pianos.
Right.
Production of Malted Media.